Welcome to Building the Future, Freedom, Prosperity, and Foreign Policy with Dan Rundy. I am Errol Yabuke. I'm not Dan Rundy. I am his senior fellow and deputy director with the Project on Prosperity and Development here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we're really, really excited to have my friend and colleague, Melissa Dalton, on the podcast today. She and I have been doing a really interesting and I think really important work and study on stabilization and how we can think about how to use all the tools that we have in our interagency government toolbox to provide better outcomes and more conflict-aware outcomes in stabilization contexts. So before we dive into stabilization, though, Melissa, welcome. And please tell us a little bit about you and your project and what you do here at CSIS.
Thanks so much, Errol, for having me on today. It's truly been delightful to be partnering with Errol and the PPD team on this stabilization initiative. I'm Melissa Dalton. I direct what we call the Cooperative Defense Project here at CSIS, which seeks to reinforce the principled foundations of U.S. defense policy and military operations. And really at the core of that work is digging into some of the critical civil-military coordination and planning issues when the U.S. military is engaged globally, needing to work by, with, and through both local civilian and security partners, but also the necessary ingredients from the broader U.S. government to achieve U.S. foreign policy objectives and how all that comes together. So it's been great to partner on this stabilization project together and really looking forward to the discussion here today.
Thanks, Melissa. You know, I remember when I first came to CSIS, you were one of the first people that I met. And I was excited to be at CSIS because as someone who has spent a previous career, let's say, in humanitarian aid and international development, but in fragile states, I came across so many people in the security and defense space. And I met my fair share of civil military officers, whether it was in Ramadi or Juba. And I just felt like there was more work that we could do together. And I felt like we were operating in the same environments. And being at CSIS is the perfect opportunity, I think, for the Melissas and the Errols of the world to come together and actually think strategically and in a decaffeinated way, let me say, about what we should do in these areas. And so building on that first meeting, I think you and I started talking about we should really do something together. And then the administration put out something called the Stabilization Assistance Review. So tell us a little bit about that and how we came to actually formalize our partnership here at CSIS.
Yeah, the administration in 2018 put out the Stabilization Assistance Review. And I think it's worth noting that this was a document signed out by the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and the USAID administrator, which would be, you know, a high bar in any administration, but I think particularly notable in this one to have that level of interagency consensus around what has historically been a pretty contentious issue following on the mixed record of the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is still playing forward. So I think what's notable about the SAR, as it's called, the SAR framework, is that first it puts forward an actual definition for stabilization that is U.S. government-wide. This is no small matter, given the proliferation of what people actually mean by stability operations or to stabilize conflict areas. Historically thinking about it more in military terms or, you know, after conflict, something that's an afterthought, you know, and unfortunately, again, seeing some of the repercussions of thinking that way playing out in places like in Iraq and Afghanistan and living with the consequences of that today. So the fact that there is an actual common definition for those three major departments and agencies to drive forward with and across the interagency is a good thing. What's key about it also is that it makes very clear that stabilization is a political activity that needs to be linked to political outcomes, political objectives. And then from there, the planning and alignment throughout the U.S. interagency should flow. The other premises for the SAR are that stabilization should be a targeted, burden-sharing, burden-shifting endeavor that places ownership front and center with local partners on which our collective success rests. The enduring solutions really depend on their credibility, legitimacy, and capacity. So ensuring that we're thoughtful about our approaches in empowering local partners going forward is also at the centerpiece of the SAR. But I think what struck us about the SAR coming out was, this is well and good, but how do we actually operationalize this, given the legacy of stabilization in Iraq and Afghanistan, given the different interpretations of what this actually means in particular contexts? How do you bring it all together? And so we started thinking about particularly connecting the policy level to the field and how we can build better bridges between those two communities and actually take what I think, you know, is the really great foundation that the SAR lays out and make it actionable.
Right, because I think, I couldn't agree with all that more, Melissa. I think it was a victory getting a common definition. It was a victory having that definition focus on political outcomes. It would be a failure if we ended there. And so I think that we were really excited to almost have a track two process outside people that care about this, like us and like some of our colleagues here at CSIS and in the broader community. We convened people and we wrote a couple of policy briefs. It's worth mentioning, Melissa, that we were allowed to kick off our efforts thanks to the generous support of Chemonics International, and we're very excited about our partnership with them. But we wouldn't have been able to do this had there not been a lot of energy in town and energy in the interagency. Say that one five times fast. And I think that that was real, and we tapped into something. And not to put the cart too far before the horse, but we are going to be having a big event on April 30th where we're going to be hosting Assistant Secretary of State Denise Natale, who is herself really dedicated to this. And so we would invite all of Building the Future's listeners to join us, whether it's online or in person, at CSIS on April 30th for that event. But before we get to that event and where we're going from here, Melissa, let's talk about what we've learned so far. We co-authored, together with some of our other colleagues here at CSIS, a policy brief that came out in, I believe, January of this year. Tell us a little bit about some of the high-level takeaways from that.
You know, I think we were, rather than constructing a big report that would come out at the end of our research process, we were really keen to try to give some grist back to policymakers that are looking at how to operationalize the SAR real-time and as we went. And, you know, again, just want to really emphasize the clear commitment of stakeholders in government, not only to their internal process, but in their willingness to engage us on this project. So we have basically broken our findings into the policy brief that came out in January and a forthcoming one that'll come out in April. So for the January one, we first wanted to take a step back and think about how the SAR and more broadly this new way of thinking about stabilization into the strategic context of where the United States is in the world and how this particular tool set can be employed going forward. So the SAR, I think, really nicely lays out and rightly lays out the importance of thinking about stabilization as something that is planned alongside military operations, particularly as a way to consolidate gains after those military operations end. And so you have to be laying the ingredients in as you go, planting those seeds, and empowering the local actors at the governance level to pick up alongside of the security forces that are trying to clear areas. So it's not necessarily a clear phase break between clearing and building, that you're doing that in tandem. So I think that's quite right and is really fitting for thinking about contexts like counter-ISIS in Syria and Iraq. As we've cleared Raqqa, as we've cleared Mosul, what stabilization can look like in those contexts. I think it's also important to point out, though, you know, particularly with the strategic emphasis of the United States on the challenges posed by state-based actors like Russia and China, to a lesser extent, Iran and North Korea, that are presenting a range of security considerations, particularly in the gray zone, hybrid type challenges, and the role that stabilization tools can play in building the resiliency of allied and partner institutions in places like Ukraine, in places like Southeast Asia. We think about those tools in a different way in those contexts, in terms of how state-based actors might, through disinformation operations or through economic investments, try to entrap our partners in ways that undermine the foundations of their governance models that are closely aligned with ours, and how that can be detrimental to their stability over the medium to long term. So thinking about stabilization in those contexts, I think, is also really important and needs to be elevated in things like how the Department of Defense is implementing, for example, the defense strategy and the role of irregular warfare going forward, that stabilization is actually a way of accomplishing those set of objectives as well. So that, just in terms of the strategic framing for stabilization going forward, I think we spent some time fleshing that out in the first policy brief. And then turning to, you know, some of the challenges ahead, as the SAR does point out the importance of working with and enabling local partners, but we also spent some time unpacking how that can present some challenges for the U.S., because sometimes the divergences between U.S. and partner objectives, ensuring the alignment of how we want to actually implement stabilization to achieve our combined political goals, sometimes we're not on the same page. And so how you navigate that through a credible process. And then, you know, in thinking about local contexts, you know, the partners that the United States may want to work with, particularly in contested or counterterrorism type contexts, may not be the most legitimate or empowered actors in the local context, and that the more powerful or credible actors in that context may be actually off the table for us in terms right. of counterterrorism restrictions that are there for good reason from a U.S. national security and legal perspective, but actually make it quite difficult for us if the goal is stabilization and that political trajectory. So, you know, I think that's an important area to dig into with SAR implementation.
I think it's a really important point. I mean, you talk about gray zones and you talk about complex scenarios. Really, this is just messy
yes.
in these places, right? And it's not clear a lot of times who our friends are and who our enemies are. And sometimes we have frenemies. And that's just the reality of the situation. And I think what we're trying to think about, and I think what the SAR framework is trying to do, is give us a new way of thinking about this world that's not quite clear cut in the way that maybe yep. we thought it was in the past. And so how do we do that? How do we use all of the tools at our disposal, from sacks of rice to bullets and everything in between? How do we, yeah. you know, when and how do we deploy those tools to get the best outcomes? And like you said, I mean, not all of these people are great actors that yep. we work with. And so we are no longer doing nation building, apparently. We learned, I think, from Iraq and Afghanistan that that's a really hard thing to do. It's a really resource-intensive thing to do. And so I think it's a useful exercise for us to update our approaches based on this new understanding of today's reality.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think part of the key or part of the answer is coming up with the roadmap, as we described in our first policy brief, just being incredibly rigorous about what our U.S. outcomes and objectives are, and then doing that mapping exercise with the partner to understand where there is a convergence, and then focusing there and really driving towards that in a measurable and concrete way. And having those feedback loops between the U.S. and the partner, amongst the interagency, amongst coalition partners. And I think this is an issue that we're really going to dig into in our forthcoming policy brief as well, the importance of all those partnerships. But as it relates to the roadmap, just being incredibly rigorous and consistent in terms of the methods that we're applying as we go to ensure that we're driving towards and revisiting the way that we're going to achieve our outcomes and objectives. And it may be that those outcomes and objectives need to shift over time, not in a right. mission creep kind of way, but to reflect changes domestically here in the U.S. in terms of where the partner is, in terms of, you know, in these incredibly complex environments, the introduction of external actors or other militias that pop up on the scene. You need to have it be a fairly dynamic and feedback-intensive process, which raises some interesting questions in terms of capacity and resourcing for an already pretty strapped national security apparatus and incredibly capable but busy implementers on the ground. And then, you know, from an accountability standpoint, you know, how do we raise the level of oversight to ensure that we're actually accomplishing our objectives with taxpayer dollars, but that allow for potential failures on a pathway to success, and getting Congress comfortable with the idea that with a certain level of transparency, there are going to be those missteps because it is so fluid, it is so messy, as you pointed out.
I think that's a really important point. And I think that leads nicely into the work that we're currently doing that's going to result in, like you said, another policy brief coming out in April. And I mentioned that this is all messy, and I wish that we had an eloquent, simple answer for how do we implement stabilization in these contexts. I think what readers will see when they, hopefully everybody that's listening here will go download the next policy brief coming out in April. But I think what you'll see when you do read it is that these challenges mean that no one part of an agency or part of a department, whether it's state or DOD or USAID, nobody can do this alone. And in fact, the US government can't even do this alone. We need partners. We need partners in the interagency. We need international partners, whether they're bilateral or multilateral. And we need to have a better way of incentivizing our people who are operating in those environments. And oh, by the way, the policy people that are back here in DC, we need to incentivize all those people to work towards a common objective. And doing so, I have to be honest, we delve into a little bit of wonk in this next policy brief because we have to talk about things like tools and authorities. Mm-hmm. We have to talk about funding. We have to talk about Congress's role in this. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the important things that we do is, as you mentioned at the beginning, we also have to talk about the people that are tasked with actually doing this stuff in the field, mm-hmm. the implementers. And I think that's something that the SAR leaves out a little bit. And we have to recognize that it is those people that are on the front lines mm-hmm. that are actually delivering a lot of the services that together constitute stabilization. I think the other thing that we realized we had to touch on in this next one is we had to acknowledge, and I'm going to steal a Melissa Dalton term here, we had to acknowledge that there was significant scar tissue from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think that's okay as long as we learn from that scar tissue and as long as we build on it and we address some of the challenges to success that we saw in the Iraqs and Afghanistans. Nobody holds up Syria as a prime example of what everybody should do all the time by any stretch of the imagination. But I think that there are some really good tactical interagency lessons that can be learned, and not just interagency, but how do you partner with international partners? And I think that we will delve into some of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's just right. And I think it's not a new observation to note that every ally and partner, every local actor in a particular context has comparative advantages to bring to bear. And so, again, going back to this idea of doing the rigorous mapping up front, the coordination to understand how all of those elements can be brought together, and then regularly reassessing them as we go to match the strategy, to match that stabilization process is key. I think the other thing that we try to cover in the forthcoming brief, or will cover, is the need to take a look at, do we have the right authorities and resourcing to accomplish this way of doing stabilization going forward? Our current authorities are perhaps best met for another era that may still be useful in certain ways in a 21st century context, but I think it's worth a review of how do they fit together? Do they actually meet the intent of this way of doing stabilization going forward, given the fluidity, given the range of actors, both state-based and non-state-based, with which the United States is going to have to interact? The need to politically and fiscally increasingly burden share or burden shift, do we have the authorities and mechanisms to allow for international contributions? You mentioned Syria as an example of innovation. I think that's right. Beyond the headlines, at a very technocratic level, there have been innovations in the field in terms of how to integrate international contributions from regional partners, from other allies, into U.S. programming to enable us to continue stabilization resourcing, even as the U.S. has been drawing down its own foreign assistance contributions to the Syria mission. So I think that's important. I think Syria is also important to note in terms of being a non-state actor context where we are conducting stabilization there without the permission of the Syrian government, which has compelled us over the years to adapt to a regionally based platform where we have teams operating out of Turkey and Jordan, some elements in Iraq, with the ability to flow, start forward, they call it, into Syria to engage with local actors, but really empowering those local actors to conduct stabilization on the ground. So I think there are some useful lessons to be drawn from there and important to keep in mind when thinking about stabilization going forward. I mean, I feel like we always trip over the question of what are the success stories of stabilization? Because people have, to the scar tissue point, Iraq and Afghanistan as their frame of reference. So, you know, I think through the Syria example, other smaller scale, medium scale stabilization endeavors that are ongoing, the ability to lift those up through assessment, monitoring, and evaluation and present those to the Hill, to policymakers of, okay, you know, this is a snapshot in time of a longer term story, but this is actually what's working here. And here are innovations that can be shared with the broader community.
Yeah, and I think that you mentioned moving beyond the headlines, and I think that's really critical here because in places like Mali, in places like Colombia, they probably, you know, are those places perfect? Certainly not. Did both of those places, especially Colombia, see an interagency, let's bring all of our tools that are in the toolbox together to bear to handle what is a complex problem? I mean, in the 1990s, Colombia was arguably a failed narco state. And we kind of figured out how, with some international partners and with multilateral institutions and with different arms of the U.S. government, we kind of figured out how to create some sort of semblance of stability. And I think moving beyond the headlines to me means not necessarily forgetting about those technocratic, technical wins, because ultimately we need to put together a series of those technocratic, tactical wins in the complex challenge of tomorrow that ultimately will lead us to better outcomes that maybe one day make it into the headlines, although, you know, I have some skepticism that they'll ever, you know, good news never makes it to the headlines. But, you know, where do we go from here, Melissa? Like, you know, you mentioned assessment, monitoring, and evaluation, which I think is really critical. I think telling the story is really critical. But where do we at CSIS and where does this stabilization conversation need to be going in the next 6 months to a year?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth test driving some of these ideas through field research. You know, Errol and I think are thinking through how to extend this research in that way, because I think that is a critical way to connect the local voices that are making these innovations on the ground. You know, I think Mali is a really interesting example where you actually have had the French in the lead, you know, for conducting that stabilization effort. So bringing those forward to a DC policy audience, I think, is going to be important. I think it's also worth reflecting on how our other allies are thinking about conducting stabilization going forward. You know, both the Brits and the Germans have been either already putting out or in the process of putting out their own new policies and doctrine on how to conduct stability operations going forward. So, you know, is there goodness that it can be shared in the allied community? Because the reality is, you know, in any of the particularly more larger scale stabilization endeavors, we're going to be there as a coalition. So seeing where that connective tissue exists and then, you know, seeing what each of us can bring to bear in the future, I think, is also important. And I know there's no political appetite to think about what a stabilization mission on the scale of Iraq and Afghanistan will be. But, you know, just to echo your point, Errol, about harvesting the best practices, the innovations through these smaller to medium scale stabilization operations that are out of the headlines will be critical for when and if, you know, God forbid, we have to do one of those larger scale operations down the road, that you've collected those innovations and hopefully brought up the community to a certain level of knowledge and shared experience such that we can do better next time.
I think that's a great note to end this conversation on, because I think our goal here at CSIS and I think in our two programs is always to be putting out publicly available information for policymakers that hopefully will allow them to do it better next time. With that, thank you, Melissa. This has been very, very interesting. Thanks to all of our listeners for joining us on Building the Future, Freedom, Prosperity, and Foreign Policy with Dan Rundy. Until next time.